colder. My eyes go thin as I get older. Piece in pieces, bloody and bruised. I feel so helpless and confused. 'Cause I hear screaming on the left, yelling on the right. I'm sitting in the middle trying to live my life.
Well, hello, everyone. This is Evelyn Pringle, and I'm here to welcome you to my show, Focus on the Facts. And today I'm excited. I have a special friend coming on, Kelly Patricia O'Meara. She's an award-winning investigative reporter for the Washington Times Insight magazine, and she's written dozens of articles exposing the fraud of the psychiatric diagnosis, invented diseases, and the dangers of psychiatric drugs. She wrote a cover story in 1999 for Insight magazine called Guns and Doses, and she was the first journalist to report and expose the link between school shootings and psychiatric drugs in her 1999 cover story. And so she's going to come on today, and she's done some reporting on suicides in the military and the drugging that's going on in there. And I'm real happy to have her because when I first started writing about pharma, Kelly was an inspiration to me. And she was always available to discuss the issues. And I'd like her welcome to the show, Kelly O'Meara.
How you doing, Evie?
Good.
Can you hear me okay?
I was reading over your articles on the suicide in the military, and I'm just amazed that you've kept up on this. And I wanted to ask you one thing. Did you, you've been writing about this for so long, these drugs and what they're doing to people and everything, but do you ever get discouraged? You know, that you've been reporting what these drugs cause and what they do to people and everything, but it seems like we can't end this drug company marketing of these drugs.
Well, you know, I don't get discouraged. I think that eventually, and I do think small steps are being taken. I think people are becoming much more aware of the dangerous side effects of these drugs. I think that people are starting to question the validity of the psychiatric diagnosis, especially when it comes to their kids. I hope that, you know, we'll see a future that won't have, you know, so much drugging. But all I can do is write about it and try and make people aware, as you do, Evie. You have been writing about this for a very long time, and I respect your writing equally.
I said in the opening that you really inspired me, you know, when I read your articles and stuff, when I started writing about pharma. I think it was back in 2003, and you had
Well, you made me writing. Sound really old.
No. But
I was a child.
Right. Well, you know, what I got discouraged about was, you know, I focused so much on trying to get these drugs away from kids, you know.
Right.
And I haven't really been writing that much on pharma lately. And a while back I had wrote, you know, how they were drugging, you know, infants less than a year old.
Right.
And at the time, I reported, I think it was 23 in Florida in the Medicaid records I found in a year that had been prescribed antipsychotics, the strongest psychiatric drugs out there that
right.
they used to only give to people that were in mental institutions, for God's sake. So, but then the next year, lo and behold, those kids overcame their mental illness. There wasn't any prescribed to kids less than a zero.
Interesting. Isn't that funny how that works?
That worked that one year. But I think I've seen a headline lately that all these infants again are on these drugs.
Yeah, you know, I thought we might talk a little bit about that today, seeing how we're going to talk about the drugging of America's youth. Let's look at some data that was provided by IMS Health, which basically is the largest vendor of prescribing data. And this
right.
is information that was pulled from the national database in 2013, okay?
Okay.
Just so your listeners kind of get an idea of how bad the situation actually is. So in 2013, the way we break it down is all the psychiatric drugs between the ages of 0 and 5. Now, that includes anti-anxiety meds, antipsychotics, antidepressants, the ADHD drugs, okay? So we have
right.
a million 0 to 5 year olds, a million 0 to 5 year olds who have been prescribed one of those drugs, okay?
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. And that was in 2013. We have just right. 0 to 1 year old, we have 274,000. Those are babies
oh
who are being prescribed.
Oh, my God.
Extraordinarily dangerous mind-altering drugs, okay?
Oh, yes. Yes.
ADHD drugs. Let's just look at the age groups for ADHD drugs, which is methylphenidate, Adderall, Ritalin. 0 to 1 year old, we have 1,400 babies being given.
0 to 1 year old, 1,400 babies.
1,400 of them being prescribed methylphenidate. I mean, at some point you go, and this is ADHD drugs for 0 to 5 year olds, 188,000.
Right.
How do you prescribe those to a child of that age? How do you get the diagnosis? They're wiggling too much? They're talking out of turn? Do you understand? I mean, this is criminal.
It is criminal. You know, how can these doctors go on doing this? And you know, by now, I'm getting just as angry at the parents that let this go on. Because, you know, there have been, well, you and I have been reporting, you've been reporting probably 20 years, you know, or almost, and me 12 or whatever, that there is information out there that they know what they're doing to these kids.
Well, one of the problems, Evie, as you know, and as you've written about, I've read most of your articles, probably all of them, is that, mm-hmm. you know, parents are told one thing by a doctor, and most people trust their doctors, right?
That's
and
the
they don't
mistake.
Say, hey, you know, isn't this normal behavior for a two-year-old? You know, they don't
right.
ask the next question because they believe the doctor is giving them appropriate information. And what I try to do is get people to understand that when it comes to psychiatric diagnosing and psychiatric drugging, you have to ask all the questions. You have to ask, where's the abnormality? Where is the abnormality that makes you think that this drug is going to, you know, make my child better?
Right.
They don't have right. an abnormality. There is no abnormality in the brain that is any psychiatric diagnosis. You know that, and I know that. A lot of people know
right.
that.
There's no test they can give you to document you have this
there's
disorder.
What?
I said there's no test that they can give that will document
no.
that you have any of these disorders.
Well, here, I guess the best way to look at it, and
right.
I think Dr. Fred Bauman, who I respect mm-hmm. greatly, he's a neurologist out of California.
Yes.
He sort of put it the best way. He said an objective confirmable abnormality. In other words, can you take an X-ray and find an objective confirmable abnormality in the brain for any psychiatric diagnosis? No. In other words, nothing shows up on an X-ray, a PET scan, an MRI, blood test, urine test. There is no objective test available to, you know, that would find an abnormality.
Right.
Hence, all psychiatric diagnosing is completely subjective. And if you go to different psychiatrists, you'll get different diagnoses.
Oh, right. I lived through that.
Okay, so again, when you're dealing with children, and again, remember, children's brains do not fully develop until what? Well into their 20s. But yet,
yeah. Yeah.
we're prescribing really dangerous mind-altering drugs that we know will change the brain chemicals in this child. Okay? Whether
right.
it's good, bad, or indifferent, nobody knows. They have no long-term data to show that in the case of ADHD, the alleged, mm-hmm. you know, mental disorder of children, they have, in fact, there's a quote, and it's from the FDA, and it says, quote, long-term effects of amphetamines in children have not been well established. So it's saying we don't know the long-term effect of methylphenidate on your child's brain. But go ahead and take
right.
the drug because it'll change their behavior.
Yeah.
And again, I look at this and I said, look, this is criminal. This is criminal.
It is. I think it is. I think it is. It's just, yeah. And then they got, I said, they started this when they first came out, their drug-pushing schemes were when the SSRIs first came out, Well, then, but they had been doing the Ritalin business before that with those kids, but not as young as you're talking about. But then the Ritalin and stuff makes you depressed. I mean, I was a speed freak in my 20s, and I can tell you, when you stay up for 2 days and don't sleep and don't eat or anything, you know it's coming from speed. You're going to crash. So then they take it in, well, these kids have depression too. So then they added on the SSRIs. Well, then when you put those two together, I'm sure these little kids would act really screwed up. So then they come out and they come out with these anti-seizure medications and then the new antipsychotics.
Right.
So then they develop, now they have bipolar.
Right.
So they give them those.
You know, again, Evie, what your listeners need to understand is that there was a study that came out in 2011, and it showed that adults who had taken methylphenidate, in other words, Adderall, Ritalin, you know, the ADHD drugs as children, it showed that there was widespread brain atrophy. So we know that these drugs are changing, you know, the brain of these people who are taking them. Then you add on, let's say, okay, they've been on ADHD drugs for, you know, years. They're not happy. Well, suddenly now they've been diagnosed as depressed, another non-existent psychiatric diagnosis. So we're going to add on an antidepressant, maybe a couple. You know, you never know.
Yeah.
And then they're really screwed up, and we go, okay, now they're bipolar, so let's give them an antipsychotic. These kids don't have a chance in adulthood. They don't have a chance.
No.
And
they definitely have ruined a whole generation of kids with this drug.
Well, and it's not stopping. That's the problem, and that's why you and I write about this issue, because we want people to become aware. We want the drugging of the nation's youth to stop. It doesn't treat any known abnormality. And this is why I think, you know, psychiatry needs to be sort of have their feet to the fire in front of Congress. I think we need to have some hearings, have them come in and answer some questions about their diagnosing. Because, you know, generally it's a fraud. It is not based in medicine. It is not based in science. It is purely subjective.
Right.
And yet the drugs that they're giving to treat these non-existent mental disorders are very, very dangerous. And we know this. How do we know it? The FDA has put black box warnings, the most serious warning that the FDA, you know, can put on a drug before they pull it from the market is a black box warning. And we have black box warnings on all of the antidepressants for suicidality, because these drugs can cause people to want to commit suicide.
Right.
And everybody wonders why we have such a high suicide rate.
Because I think almost all of those drugs have that warning now. You know, all the psychiatric drugs, and the ones, because now, you know, the FDA went and approved antipsychotics to add on to SSRIs to treat depression, you know, but they all have that warning on them. So when you're giving people three or four drugs every day that all have that warning, they can cause you to commit suicide, you know, look at the odds, how high they go for these people committing suicide.
And again, I mean, what we're talking about is a cocktail of mind-altering drugs, and that's...
Right.
That's very worrisome. It's almost like with the kids, you get them cradle to grave. You know, if you can get them hooked young enough, they're going to be on these psychiatric drugs for the rest of their lives. Why? Because their brain has been changed by these drugs.
Right.
It has been altered.
And, you know, you talk about a lot of people, you know, have said how hard it is to come off these drugs. And I lucked out when they had me in the mental illness category for like 13 years. Then it was right before the new drugs came out. So I didn't get put on those. And so when I got off any psychiatric drugs, when I went into treatment to sober up at 35, where the doctors watched me become an alcoholic, these drugs didn't help me, you know, whatever they said I had. And I got treatment, and I got, you know, codependency treatment, adult child treatment and stuff, and I've not been to a psychiatrist again for nothing. And all the mental illnesses disappeared.
I I'm not saying that people aren't suffering, okay? I'm not saying that they're not depressed. I'm not saying that kids don't wiggle in their chairs. What I'm saying is these drugs that are prescribed as a quote-unquote treatment are not treating any abnormality. If doctors are honest, And that's what we're looking for. We're looking for informed consent. And what's informed consent? It's
right.
being honest about what's happening. It's being honest about the diagnosis. So if a doctor says to parents, you know, we don't know why your kid is wiggling in their chair. We don't know why they raise their hand out of turn. You know, we don't know why they don't complete their homework assignments. But, you know, we're going to call it ADHD because, you know, that's just what we call it. And we're going to give them this drug. We don't really know how it works in the brain to treat whatever it is they've got. Yeah, there's no honesty. It's never,
we don't know
what's going on and we don't know how this works. It's, okay, they have the mental, you know, disorder, ADHD, and this drug will treat this. And that's not true.
No, no. In fact, you know, they're destroying brains. I mean, my second daughter, her brain is destroyed from them keeping her on all these psychiatric drugs for all these years. You know, and she wouldn't listen to me and get off them, you know. And it's just like these people, they don't feel compassion. They don't, it seems like they don't care. You know, they can upset you and stuff. And it seems like it doesn't bother them. But really, her brain is so damaged from these drugs that she doesn't have empathy. She doesn't feel things. She doesn't feel guilt, shame, anything.
Well, and, the thing you know, that for 30 years they tried to pass off the chemical imbalance theory, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's a theory. For 30 years it was a theory. No one ever proved it. No, in fact, there is no way to test for a chemical imbalance in your brain. There is no test known to man. So when somebody, a doctor, says, oh, you may be suffering from a chemical imbalance, that's why you're depressed, you need to ask them for a test. Let me see the test you did. Because if they don't have a test to show that there's a chemical imbalance, and not only that there is a chemical imbalance, but which chemical, how do you give a drug? You know, how do you know what you're supposed to give them? And then who decides what is the right chemical limit for each individual?
I remember, when I started writing, I was reading your discussions on that. It made so much sense that, yeah. But they finally did admit that they don't know that.
Well, of course they did.
You know,
they
had
to. After 30 years, you kind of have to fess up and go, yeah, you know, it was a nice theory, but, you know, hey, it really never panned out. Well, that's unfortunate for all the people that believed their doctors over the years and were put on psych meds to increase, you know, the serotonin or the dopamine or the norepinephrine or whatever brain chemical it was that they were told that they didn't have enough of. That's unfortunate for them because now they're, you know, they've probably been on several psych drugs. It's very difficult to withdraw from these drugs, extremely difficult.
Oh, I know.
And people go, oh, I can't, I need it. Well, yeah, of course you do. Your brain has become used to having this additional, you know, drug.
Oh, certainly. You know, and those drugs mess up so much of you. You know, I mean, people didn't realize that, for one thing, like for adults, for sexuality, you know, they really stunt that and everything, and doctors never told you that. So, you know, when spouses or couples, one of them goes to the doctor and gets on these drugs and stuff, and all of a sudden they just quit wanting to have sex, and they don't have an explanation. They don't know it's a drug, if the doctors would be honest, you know, and tell them this. But they don't know. So the problems this causes in relationships and things, you know, that all this stuff is caused from these drugs, but they don't even know it. And that's the part, like you talked about before, about informed consent. Yeah, when a doctor's going to prescribe these drugs, he needs to sit you down and tell you all those things, that it's going to affect this part of your life and that part and everything, so that, you know, you go home and suddenly just turn away from your spouse or partner or whatever and don't want to have nothing to do with them, and you don't know it, it's just a drug.
Right.
And
right.
So I thought of this for kids, you know, that when they're growing up, what is this doing to their cycles? And I mean, and these drugs affect all different parts of your cycles. I mean, with women, for the different drugs that affect their menstruation and things like this and how they're going to reproduce. And then, like, the little kids, like, boys would go breast, you know, I mean,
that's from the antipsychotics and that's really an interesting lawsuit. I read that Johnson & Johnson just had to pay another fine on several million dollars for a case that a young guy developed, what, double D breasts?
Yeah, and have to have them cut off. I mean, what does this do to these kids?
Well, and the thing is that I think that the pharmaceutical acknowledges that they had this documentation, you know, prior to the marketing of the drug.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They knew it. You know, when
and
they
again, we
those
have 22 international drug warnings that were, you know, issued, you know, on these drugs that cite effects of mania, hostility, violence, mm-hmm. homicidality, suicidality. I mean, it just goes on, and yet people want to believe. You know, look at these, like, these are happy pills, okay? Everybody's going to be happy. Their life is going to be happy if they take these pills. That's kind of how they're sold. Oh, you're depressed? Well, mm-hmm. take this, and you'll feel better.
Right.
That's not what happens. That's not what happens at all. In fact, in many, many cases, people who take these, their lives are much worse. And they go from one drug to another, to a cocktail, you know, to another diagnosis. And it's endless. Like I said, it's cradle to grave.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we talk about the violence that's associated with these. I mean, it's very well documented at this point.
Yeah, you were the first reporter to report on that. How did you discover that?
Well, that's sort of a long story. I was doing an interview with the Citizens Commission on Human Rights back in 1999 about a psychiatrist who believed that the sooner you had sex with a child, the better off the child would be. Okay?
What?
Yeah, this was Dr. Gardner, who had written several books about it, and his whole thing was he believed that the sooner you had sex with a child, the better off they would be. So I was interviewing Citizens Commission on Human Rights about this particular psychiatrist, and after the interview was over, we, you know, sat down and talked about other things, and it was actually the Citizens Commission on Human Rights who turned me on to the fraud of ADHD. In fact,
mm-hmm.
it was a very interesting afternoon because I really didn't believe what they were telling me. So when I got back to my office at the Times, I started doing research, and lo and behold, everything they said was absolutely true. I was shocked,
God.
Okay? So I started looking at the school shooters after that, and what I found at the time when I was doing this research was that I think it was 11 of the most recent school shooters all had been on some form of psychiatric drug.
Right.
That's when I wrote Guns and Doses. So that's sort of what got me into all this, was writing Guns and Doses. And I got to tell you, my editors at the Washington Times Insight Magazine, they were, you know, just unbelievably surprised at the positive response that we got. It was just overwhelming.
Yeah. And how come, no anymore, whenever there's a shooting, I mean, we always know we're going to find out they're on these drugs, but the mainstream media still doesn't usually report that.
Well, you know why?
You know, it should be the first thing they report. Okay, another one. Sure enough.
Yeah, but they can't do that, Evie. You know why? Because they get so much money in pharmaceutical advertising, there is no way they are ever going to do that.
Right, right.
That's
exactly
what holds them back. And that's why, you know, it's left to us to continue to write about this issue and try and make people aware of how important it is that they talk to their doctors and they question their doctors about these diagnoses. And if they are informed, if they are given all the information and they decide to take the drugs, get informed about the side effects of the drug before you accept, you know, taking them, especially when it comes to your kids, because, you know, they can't fight for themselves. You're making a very, very big decision about your child's
right.
life.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think about this now? That some states you can go and get on these drugs without your parents even knowing it. I was just appalled when I read that because it was like, well, if you don't even know you're the parent and you don't even know that child is on these drugs, how do you know them when they do something it isn't caused from these drugs?
Evie, you're enlightening me on something I don't know anything about. When did we find this out?
I found it out quite a while ago, I'd say. In the last year or something, but I think it was New Jersey or one of those states that you can go and get mental health treatment without telling your parents. And I was just appalled.
Who's paying for the treatment and the drugs?
Oh, I'm sure they got it hooked up with Medicaid and stuff, like when Bush put out that new Freedom Commission thing, you know, and Teen Screen came out and stuff, he allotted money for that and allotted money to, if your family didn't have enough money that they Medicaid would pay for the drugs. So I'm sure they fit that in there, which is bankrupt in our U.S. healthcare system.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, actually. I don't know that we're going to get too much in depth into what it's doing to the health system, but it certainly is a very, very large burden on the taxpayers.
Oh, absolutely, and that's what got Senator Grassley there investigating it, because that's where it showed up in the healthcare records, you know, the vast amount of money that was being spent on these drugs.
Yeah,
you know,
and it only goes up every year, and Medicare and Medicaid are just off the charts. And actually, psychiatric services, mental health services, are actually the thing that is going up faster than any other.
I wouldn't doubt it, because they probably know that they're pretty soon going to be run right out of the business. So they're getting as much as they can. But yeah, the cost of those drugs, I mean, when I was reporting, I'd watch every year, you know, and the cost went up. I mean, it was up to, the antipsychotics were over $1,000 a month. Just for them. I mean, I figured out one time when I did this, I took this chart that them quacks and academics put out on drugging little kids, you know. And for a bipolar, by the end, if you took all the drugs they told you to at that time, you would have been paying $50,000 a year for that kid's bipolar in pills. That ain't even counting the doctor's visits. Just in pills for that kid. And I said, when I wrote that article, what other field of medicine would parent fork out $50,000 a year for a diagnosis you couldn't even verify? But that was the chart they put out on how to treat this.
Right.
Adding the drugs, you know, but this didn't work. Add another one. Add another one. Yeah.
Right, right. Oh, absolutely.
It's just insane.
And the thing is that they don't work. This is the biggest fraud is people don't understand. This is what I have to, I continually write this over and over and over again. I can't say it enough. There is no science to the diagnosis. There's no science.
Right.
It's not medicine. It's like psychiatry is to medicine what astrology is to astronomy. Okay?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's yaya. It's somebody's opinion of your behavior.
Right.
And
you know,
if you go to five different psychiatrists, you can get five different diagnoses. It's like, people don't understand. There is no objective test that will find an abnormality in your brain that is even one of these psychiatric diagnoses. In fact, what are there? Oh, there's over 400 psychiatric diagnoses in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the APA.
Right.
You know, they have one. I don't know if you read my book or not, Psyched Out, but I listed some of the other, you know, we're so used to hearing schizophrenia and bipolar and depression and ADHD. Well, those are the big four, you know. They've got drugs.
Mm-hmm.
They can make a lot of money off drugs for those, okay?
Right.
But if you read the DSM, there are hundreds of other psychiatric diagnoses, okay, such as disorder.
Right. I just put out an article on my Facebook. I put a bunch of articles today that people want to go and, you know, look over what we're talking about. I put yours and I put some of mine. That, yeah, we discussed this, how they, and we found out, like, I put an article up on the DSM billing Bible, and 100% of the ones that were writing the criteria for mood disorders and for schizophrenia were on the drug company payrolls.
Right.
And 80% of the other ones.
Right.
You know, so they're just paid to do this.
Well, and it's all, and they vote these disorders into existence. It's a raise, you know, you raise your hand, you think, you know, bipolar is real? Yeah, okay, so that's how it's voted into existence. They just vote on it.
Right.
There's no medicine, there's no science to support these diagnoses, okay?
No.
I mean, like I said, I looked at tax disorder, and people get this disorder in April.
You get, look at what disorder?
Tax.
Yes.
T-A-X. Every April, they get tax disorder.
Oh, tax disorder. Is it in there?
It's in there.
Oh, my God.
And then they have writing disorder, and they have mathematics disorder.
Oh,
and I'm like,
It's
ridiculous.
Oh,
if you really read the DSM, it's actually sort of funny. It's funny because you'll learn just how ridiculous some of these disorders that they voted into existence are. I mean, where exactly in the brain do you think you'll find tax disorder?
I don't know.
And only in April.
Yeah, right, and only in April. But wasn't it this one, too, that they passed that thing about sexual libido or something for women? That they have a problem, and I'm sure it was, well, they've been trying to, those ones that have the ED drugs for men, they've been trying to get that in there forever.
They did, I wrote about this about a month ago. They came out with a new drug, it's called Addy, okay? And Addy is for women who are suffering from the mental disorder of not wanting to have sex with their husband, okay? The difference between Viagra and Addy, which is an antidepressant, that women are being told, if you take this antidepressant, you'll want to have sex with your husband. It's ridiculous.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Viagra actually treats a physical condition in men with the blood flow. Okay?
Right, right.
But women who don't want to have sex with their husbands, they're suffering from a mental disorder.
Yeah, right.
I mean, well, I don't know, if you're insulted, but I think it's pretty insulting.
It is insulting. And they used to want to push Viagra for women. You know, that's what they started out with. And I was telling people then, well, as far as I understand Viagra, all it does is make the blood flow in it so the men get a hard on. And I said, what is a woman going to do? Walk around all day with her blood, you know, bursting out in her crotch? What is that going to do?
Well, the difference is that one is physical, one is medical, and the other, of course, in psychiatry's view, is that women are suffering from a mental illness if they don't want to have sex with their husband.
Oh, for God's sake.
And that's insulting, and every woman should be insulted by it, and they should be additionally insulted by the fact that they're pushing an antidepressant to treat it.
Right, right. Oh, and I'm sure that the sales are up on that. Did you look into that?
Well, it just came out. It just got approved by the FDA about a month and a half ago.
Oh, yeah. I have to look into that. I just can't believe this stuff. And our regulatory agencies in every area are just letting the industry destroy us, you know, and the drug companies have sure been around for a long time doing it, you know, that I'm just amazed. And then, like now, it's so bad, too, with our troops. I mean, our troops are being made to fight in wars that are just for corporations and have nothing to do with us, and they're committing genocide in all these countries, killing people for no reason, and this has got to be affecting them terrible. I mean, look at the vets that are home that speak out about this, how horrible they feel, you know, that they're just sent out there to murder these people for nothing, and they're supposed to come home and get over that, our young kids, you know, bribed when they're in senior high school, for God's sakes, a big amount of money to enter the service and stuff, and go in there and be forced to do these things and torture people, and it's just, ugh.
Well, I've written extensively about the drugging of the military.
Talk about that guy named White, I think his name was. I wrote
Andrew
him about a year
White.
Ago, but I was reading your article today.
Andrew
that
White?
He died in his sleep.
Yeah, well, those are the dead in the bed veterans. These are guys who survived Iraq and Afghanistan, came home, were suffering from, you know, post-traumatic stress, were given enormous quantities of mind-altering drugs as treatment, and basically laid down, went to sleep, and died.
Right.
And there's so many of those, hundreds, literally hundreds of these cases.
Dr. Bauman was keeping track of that for quite some time, wasn't he?
Yes, he came up with, I think, like 340 or 350 cases of dead in the bed on military personnel. And again, you know, the thing is the military has sort of taken up the psychiatric sword as the go-to answer to whatever anybody in the military is feeling. If, you know, everybody's not happy, 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 well, then you've got a mental illness and we're going to treat you with psych drugs. The fact of the matter is, and I think any doctor will admit this if they're worth their salt, when you are in a combat zone, in a war situation, you're going to experience the things that other people in civilian life are not going to experience, and they're going to stick with you. You're going to remember it. You're going to have a hard time when you come home reestablishing your life. This is not a mental disorder. This is what happens. It is normal. If you come home from war and you're not feeling these things, I think at some point somebody might go, that's odd. Okay? If you have trouble sleeping, having nightmares. That's a normal reaction to a war combat situation.
Right.
Instead of treating it as something normal that happens to men and women who are in a war and combat situation, they've now pathologized it and made it a mental disorder that needs to be treated. And so what we are finding is that our military are really drugged up.
Well, like now, because, you know, like Dr. Peter Bregan, you know, told me that back when Vietnam and stuff, nobody was picked up if they had a mental illness. Nobody was on psych drugs and stuff back then. You know, they would know that, no, they're not, it's not suitable if you had a mental illness to send them to war. And, but now they're put on all these drugs while they're over there.
Well, they're given, I think, 120 days supply of psych drugs in a bag.
Oh, for God's
that they can take any time they want with nobody overseeing it. Just, you know, pop an Ambien here. How about an antidepressant there? You know, it's crazy.
Speed here. Yeah.
And so when they come home, you know, they're pretty messed up.
Right, right. And back
so
in
what
Vietnam,
do they do? They go to the VA or they go to, you know, the military doctor.
They're
and,
not getting the services, too. Yeah.
Let's give you some different drugs.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting. One of the interesting facts about the drugging of the military is that I want to say it's 80% of the military who has been diagnosed with PTSD has never seen combat.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, so what's that all about?
I don't know. I really don't know.
So, and again, if you are diagnosed with PTSD, you're going to get an antidepressant or an anti-anxiety or an antipsychotic or maybe a cocktail of these drugs. I call it Franken-pharmacy, okay,
yeah,
because
right.
they have no idea what
right.
they're doing. None of these drugs are ever tested in combination. In other words, Eli Lilly doesn't go, hey, let's try Prozac and Ambien and Risperdal all together, and let's do some clinical trials and see how they all work together. They don't do that.
Right. But they're handing them out to people and little kids like that. They've never been tested on an animal, for God's sake.
The military and in civilian life, this is how these drugs are being prescribed, and they have never, ever been tested in human beings in combination. So they have no idea what the effect of these drugs is going to be. It's, as I say, it's Franken-pharmacy. It truly is Franken-pharmacy.
And the other thing, too, with our soldiers now, before, in Vietnam, if you went and you put 1 year in and you made it, you got to come home and that was it. Now they're being sent to these killing fields all over the place and just killing innocent civilians constantly. And, I mean, like in Ukraine, they don't even, their own people won't fight because they're committing genocide and having to do it on their own people. They're expected to go and kill their aunts or uncles or relatives in a side of the country. And that's why they can't even keep any soldiers. But they're making our soldiers go in there and do this. I mean, how can they live through this? What our country is making them do. You know, torturing people.
That's a much larger discussion, probably for another time, but all I know is that when they're coming back having taken a lot of psych drugs over there. We have 22 suicides a day in the military with our veterans. Okay, our veterans are committing suicide. 22. In fact, I just saw a commercial on the American Hero channel. I don't know if you get that channel on television. And they were running a commercial. And they're giving that statistic out, and I thought, how interesting. I started writing about that, I don't know, about 2 years ago, and finally on this commercial, they're trying to raise money for one of these veterans groups, and they're saying, 22 veterans are committing suicide, you know, every day. What they don't say is it's because they're taking, you know, a cocktail of psychiatric drugs that can cause suicidality.
Sure.
So, you know.
And they're not getting help anyhow. You know, I mean, I read an article a few weeks ago where 300 and some thousand soldiers died before they got help from the VA. So I'm waiting.
But again, this is a much larger question, though. What help were they getting? What help were they seeking? Was it mental health?
For all different things. they're on waiting list.
Was it a physical? Was it a physical ailment? Was it mental health?
Oh.
Because I can tell you, the VA right now, their big push is the mental health.
Well, they might be doing that now, but this wouldn't have been from this year. It was a study probably from last year, the year before, or something. But they went through these waiting lists, and 300 and some soldiers died while they were on the waiting list, and never got to see anybody for whatever was wrong with them. And I mean,
did they die, or did they commit
real
suicide?
Serious things. No, well, that would be, it would cover any kind of death.
Oh, okay.
They died, you know, from the illness they had or the whatever, you know. But that many people were on a waiting list that died and never got seen by the VA for their problems. And how can we allow this to happen? So these kids that we take right out of high school and bribe them to go into this, and then they come home and they don't have any help. And look at how many are homeless, too. This is the thing, you know.
Well,
our
it's a scandal, and it's you know, until the veterans stand up, okay, and start screaming about this themselves.
You know what they do,
that's
but they
what
don't
it
put
took out of Phoenix. That's what it took, is for the veterans to finally get very vocal. Then it's
but
not going to change.
They do, but the protests aren't shown on TV or nothing. It seems like nobody's doing this. They are all the time. They just were like 3 days in Washington, bitching about the medicine, you know, dumping their bottles, their pharmaceutical bottles of VA-prescribed psych drugs and stuff, you know, on the ground in front of the White House,
right,
telling them
that
they don't want this. Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. It's not on mainstream news, so, I mean, I have to go all over to find this stuff, but it's out
well,
there.
Well, it was.
You know, and
I disagree. That was on mainstream media. That was the lead story on AOL, which is, you know, I mean, millions of people see that. That's where I saw it. I mean, look, if you're looking for the mainstream press to, you know, stand up and fight for the vets, that's not going to happen, okay? The vets have to stand up and fight for themselves, and they did it, and they are doing it. I mean, I think that it was their voices that got Congress to at least start holding hearings about what was going on in the VA hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
But no, do I think that mainstream press is going to stand up and go, oh, these drugs are terrible and, you know, they're committing suicide because they're put on, you know, 8, 9, 20 psychiatric drugs in a year? No, they're not going to do that.
Yeah, would you find
too much
that
money
story
to be made.
That two of them? And didn't you find there were 54 drugs between them they had been prescribed?
Between the two kids, yeah.
Yeah.
One kid
yeah.
needed a backpack to carry all the bottles of drugs every day.
Oh, my God. Oh, man.
That was Andrew White. He had to have all his drugs in a backpack. That's how many bottles he had.
Yeah.
And that's a, you know, that's a scandal.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is.
But I got to tell you, it's going to take you and I, other writers, continually writing about it, making people aware, and it's going to take the veterans speaking up.
Right. Right.
And eventually, the media won't be able to turn their head. They will have to report it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, elections can be won and lost based on what millions of veterans are talking about. So lawmakers
mm-hmm.
are going to wake up, too. It just takes
right.
time. I don't even think the people in the military and our veterans, I don't even think they realized until recently what was going on with the drugging.
No, I don't think so.
And I think it's only recently that they are aware of it, and they're going, hey, enough of this. This isn't working.
Right.
In fact,
right.
they're probably worse off than they were when they came home. If they had been treated without psych drugs and had somebody listen to them, you know, that's when they were missing in this country is compassion. Nobody wants to listen
right.
to what people have gone through in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
We have no compassion mm-hmm. whatsoever. Why? Because the pharmaceuticals have told us we have a drug that will make you happy.
Yeah, right.
So here, take this drug and get out of my face. I mean, that's basically kind of what it's become.
Right.
Nobody has time to listen to what somebody has experienced and what's wrong and not working in their life. Because, you know, hey, the pharmaceuticals have drugs for us.
Yeah, right.
And that's not true.
They tell them it's going to make you go away. No. No. When I had my alcohol and drug treatment centers, I got people from Vietnam that were still having PTSD say, you know, I treated them. I never sent one to get any drugs. I treated them. You know, that they needed to talk about this stuff and they needed to get it off their chest and be able to openly talk about it and let it out of themselves and stuff. And it was no big deal. Yeah, it's painful to listen to as a counselor, you know, but
sure,
that's what they needed.
Of course.
There was no drug I could send them to get.
But that's expensive. That's expensive to send thousands and thousands of veterans to talk therapy. It's cheaper just to give them a pill.
Yeah, but you know what? Martha and I were talking about that last year. Do you know when I had them treatment centers, my treatment went three groups a week for 6 weeks, plus one-on-ones in that time with personal counseling, and a family program for the whole family for a weekend, and then 12 weeks of aftercare. Now, that's all talk therapy. $2,600 for the whole thing is all I charged. So when they keep saying this, that, well, maybe it is now, but back then when I had that, that's all I charged for the whole program. And there's no drugs involved. I never, ever sent anybody to get any drugs. You know, so this is so bizarre how this got turned around, and especially as the prices of psych drugs went up so much. One month's Seroquel will be $1,000. I mean, it's just insane.
It is insane.
And right, it's not helping them. You know, how are the whites doing?
Well, as far as I know, they're getting on with their lives. But, you know, I don't know, how does a parent ever get over the death of their son who, you know, went to war, came home, and, you know, literally died
right
in his sleep from drugs?
Right, right.
And were prescribed to treat him. That's the, you know, this is the madness of it. All those drugs, that cocktail of drugs he was given, you know, we're supposed to treat him, to help him. You know, he went in because he was having, you know, trouble sleeping, you know, nightmares.
Sure.
And they just drugged him.
Yeah.
And that's sad. And they have to live with that, you know, the loss of their son and how he died. And that's very sad.
Yeah, it is. And they really put in a lot of effort to expose this.
Yeah,
I talked with them years ago. You know, I wrote about it too, and they really put in a lot of effort to get this exposed, what they're doing to our young people.
And God bless them for doing that. You know, again, it's going to take people who are suffering from the treatment to stand up and go, enough is enough. You and I can write about it. We can talk about it. You know, give them the facts. But it's going to take their voice to stop it.
Right. Right. Well, I talk about, you know, when I was, say I was a speed freak when in my 20s, and, you know, I don't think I ever would have got off that. But at the time, they started banning it because they were giving it out for diet, and anybody could go and get it. And then they banned it, you know, and this was been in the 70s. And so, but now, you can go to the doctors and get it, and I got off the speed because I couldn't take the streets of it. It would make me sick. So when
are you talking about fentanyl?
Yeah, that was the big one, wasn't it?
Yeah, killed a lot of women. They finally took that off the market.
Yeah, yeah.
Caused heart attacks.
Oh, sure, sure. And they had FDA meetings about that, too.
Right.
That's always a broken record. They don't do anything about it. You know, and these little kids, yeah. You know, to their system, to their organs, all these drugs are doing to them.
Yeah.
That, I mean, well, you do, too. You go to the meetings and stuff like I used to. You know, them FDA meetings when they'd be getting for warnings and stuff. And
were you at the last meeting when they were going
to
decide on the black box warning?
On which drugs?
On antidepressant.
ADHD? Oh, on antidepressant? No. I wasn't at that. I was at it for the ADHD drugs. Went to a couple of them. Yeah.
Yeah, they're just heartbreaking. They're gut wrenching to watch parents stand up holding poster sized photographs of their 11-year-old daughter who hung herself in the closet after 2 days on an antidepressant. It's It's just terrible. It's really hard to be in that room, and there's hundreds of people who are going to stand up and tell these stories.
Right, and. It's amazing how long it took you guys worked on getting those warnings on the SSRI and impressions.
Well,
you
know, the Citizens Commission on Human Rights actually was the lead organization, going after that. And, you know, I sort of came in after getting smart about the whole issue. But, yeah, they were well into it almost instantly after Prozac had been approved by the FDA.
Right, right.
Which we now know, you know, afterwards, you know, many years later, that there was abundant data that, you know, Eli Lilly did not make public, that during the clinical trials, I think this information came out during the Westbecker case, the shooting case down in Kentucky. Eli Lilly had basically not made public the suicidality associated with Prozac during the clinical trials over in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So, once again, everybody knew that the drug was causing people to think of suicide, commit suicide, and it was not made available to the FDA at the time of approval.
Right. And I know I read the transcripts on that, and they just lied right out, the CEOs of the drug companies and stuff. And in the end, didn't they bribe the jury or bribe the lawyers to the jury? And it came out later?
Yeah, I think it was something with the attorneys. But, again, we know now. It's out. The documentation is there. The information is there. You know, anyone who takes an antidepressant or any psych drug, you have to look at the black box warnings that are on the drug, and you have to look at all the side effects. Look at the neurological side effects associated with this drug. They are numerous. And no one knows the long-term effect on the brain of all these drugs.
Right. Yeah, when you're mixing them all together, then, too. And this is the thing. Like, if they would have been honest up front, look at the suicide that would have been stopped if right from the start they'd been honest and said this drug is known to cause akathisia and that feels like this and everything, and if you get that, you're going to feel frantic and everything. You need to call me because we're probably going to have to take you off it or something.
Right.
You know, I mean, if that would have been explained, because I've experienced that. I know how horrible it is.
Again, and it's you say this, psychiatrists will say, oh, it wasn't the drug that made you commit suicide. It was the mental illness. Even though they can't prove the mental illness exists, and we can prove that the drug can cause suicidality. But they'll fall back on that, oh, it was the mental illness.
You know, I'm telling you, that akathisia is so bad. I ended up going to the hospital in an ambulance. I didn't know if I was having a heart attack. I couldn't sit still. I couldn't breathe. I felt like I'm swallowing my tongue. And now that I know all about this, I realize why them people that don't succeed when they try to commit suicide said that they did it, because they didn't know any other way to stop it. It is such a horrible feeling, and you don't know what it is, and it won't go away. And I could see if somebody was stranded someplace and couldn't get to anybody that they'd be that scared that they'd rather die than live with that. But if they would have just told people that when they prescribed that drug, because it's so easy to identify when it happens.
Right.
You know, and I mean, David,
it's called informed consent. Again, I go back to that.
Yeah.
You've got to have informed consent when it comes to these drugs, and certainly the diagnosing, which, you know, of course, is completely fraudulent.
Right, right. And now what do you think about this new bit, touch on this, about the vaccines, where states making it mandatory that all the kids are going to have them with no exemptions?
Well, that's a conversation for a much larger issue. I wrote about the vaccine issue many times. I think that's a personal decision a family should make for their children.
Well, yeah.
It's taking away your right to raise your children. And it should not be legislated.
No. But I can't picture some of these parents that they'll do it. That they'll inject them concoctions into their kids. I don't care what threat they give to them. I know I wouldn't. Absolutely not. And so, you know, like I said, doing this now where you can go and get mental health services without your parents knowing it, and I heard that kids are getting vaccines in schools without their parents knowing it. I think it was Oregon or Washington. I read where 11-year-old girl can go to school and get an IUD implanted in her without her parents knowing it. This kind of stuff is scaring me to death, what they're doing to our kids.
It is scary.
I wouldn't bring a kid into this world for nothing right now. I would not bring a kid into this world. to take over our health care of our kids. You know, this is just insane. But I just can't understand how it got this way, how it got this far.
Because people bought into the system. They bought into that the state knows more than I do, that doctors are more informed than I am. And nobody knows, in my opinion, nobody knows better than a parent what their child needs.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and all these goofy vaccines like the one for cervical cancer is so ridiculous. I never heard of a girl having cervical cancer in her life in teens. Never heard of one. You know, or for boys, genital warts. I've never heard of a case of that. But forcing kids to get this. That this is just insane. That the kind of stuff they're putting into our kids, I can't get it to them.
But, well, again, that's why we're here. We have to make people aware.
But then you read me off the latest statistics of how many drugs are passing into these little infants. Oh, my God.
Yeah, let's call it what it is. It's criminal. It's criminal.
It is criminal. It
and
is
they,
criminal.
And doctors need to be held responsible for this. I mean, when you look at the list of school shooters who have been on psych drugs, you know, and don't tell me that's not a connection. When you look at all the recent military shootings, you have, you know, the Navy Yard shooter was on psych drugs. The last two Fort Hood shooters were on psych drugs. And we go down the list. The guy in Louisiana, psych drugs. This is what is causing people to go off. And people need to be aware of it. They don't even know it, probably.
Yeah, and they want to blame it all on guns. My father had guns all the time, and I was a tomboy, and I was in the rifle club and everything. I went hunting and everything. We never thought of taking that gun and going and shooting up our school or anything.
Right.
You know, no.
Right.
It's the drugs. It's the drugs.
And until people start making that connection and going, you know, I'm going to think about this before I take this drug, or I'm going to think about this before I let my child take that drug, you know, it's going to stay the same. It's going to be status quo.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really want to thank you for coming on today, lady.
Well, it has been a lot of fun. Thank you, Evie. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah. Well, I'll have you on soon because you're the most up-to-date pharma writer that I know.
I love it.
So, okay, good. Thanks a lot. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay, well, thanks, everyone, for tuning in, and I hope you learned a few things today. I know I did. Kelly's such a good guest. So I will see you next week at Monday at the same time. Bye. This tried and true in tribulation. Love is lost and lonely. Check the news. And with these open arms, I wait for you. Cause I hear screaming on the left, yelling on the right. I'm sitting in the middle trying to live my life.
Do you want to know the latest news or upcoming events? Follow us at Twitter at PRN_radio or click the Twitter icon on our homepage. You can also friend us on Facebook. Just search Progressive Radio Network. Always new and up to date. The Progressive Radio Network, your home for thoughtful and informative information.
Have you ever listened to Anthony Robbins, watched the movie called The Secret, or read about the power of positive thinking from the perspective of any of the many fine authors who have written about the subject? They all focus on the law of attraction, which governs every second of every life of every person in the universe. Like attracts like, and everything you do, feel, and think about as a regular way of being determines your life experiences. PRN's new show, LOA Today, explores all aspects of this magnificent law of the universe every Thursday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. Join hosts Walt Thiessen and Ioana June Thiessen as we explore the law of attraction each week. That's LOA Today, Thursday evenings from 7 to 8 p.m. here on PRN.
Do you want to know the latest news or upcoming events? Follow us at Twitter at PRN_radio or click the Twitter icon on our homepage. You can also friend us on Facebook. Just search Progressive Radio Network. Always new and up to date. The Progressive Radio Network, your home for thoughtful and informative information.
Live from Marilyn Monroe's former apartment in West Hollywood, this is The Smart Show. Go Harrison.
Talk show. Political. Outrageous. Philosophical. Analytical. Passionate. Sunsets. Roadkill cooking tips. Open-minded. Swordsman. Bent. Resolute. Chocolate. Bushwhacker. Belt buckles. Investigative. Companion. Fearless. Call in. Piercing the cloud of mainstream entertainment. Live from Hollywood. Go Harrison.
Except today, the sky is sunny. It's summer in Los Angeles. Go figure. It sure isn't in the rest of the world. I think on the East Coast, where PRN is located, it's probably cold and maybe overcast. I actually don't know. But in LA, it's like 89. Sunny, hot, blistering. I had to wear sunscreen today. I know, an act of cruelty for all of you who are not here. But I guess this is why we suffer living here. We may not have air to breathe. We may not have a lot of stuff, but we really never freeze to death. There, that's the upside of today's news. We're going to get into three cool topics today and really delve into what's actually going on. Not just the general official story that we're all hearing about the mysterious ISIS that suddenly came up out of nowhere. Nobody knew they were there after they'd taken over half of the Middle East, somehow invisibly, et cetera, but who they are, where they're coming from, and what does surveillance mean relative to all of this? In just a moment, we're going to go to the FBI's former special agent and division counsel, whose May 2002 memo to the FBI director exposed some of the FBI's pre-9/11 failures. And this woman, Colleen Rowley, was named one of Time Magazine's Persons of the Year in 2002. We're going to get the uptake on surveillance in Paris, expanding, giving them a little NSA love, such as we do here for the American people, although they've actually already done it twice so far in recent memory. But now is a good time to really crack down on everybody. And is this just another pretext for that, or is there some legitimacy? There's always a blend in there. The question is, what does it all mean? We're also then going to talk to Scott Klinger. He's the director of revenue and spending policies at the Center for Effective Government. And we're going to look at the 1% 401ks. You will be astounded to find out that 100 of the largest United States corporations, their CEOs, the retirement packages are worth a combined $4.9 billion. That's equal to the entire retirement account savings of half of the American families. And this is that a report that just came out by the Center for Effective Government and Institute for Policy Studies watchdog groups. That's coming up in about 20 minutes. Then we're going to go to Dallas, Texas, where there is right now going on a JFK conference. It's the third annual JFK assassination conference hosted by Judith Baker, Lee Harvey Oswald's former girlfriend. And they're going to be looking at the assassination, which says, they say, that LBJ was behind the killing of JFK. Don't know, can't say, but it is a voice certainly worthy of being heard. Let's take a look at the Guardian newspaper very quickly and very brief. They reported that since the Paris attacks happened just a few days ago, France has been living under a nationwide state of emergency not seen since 1961. So if you're like 50-something years old, that was the last time that was seen. Most of you who are listening online or streaming weren't even born, not even a zygote, not even a spermatozoa wiggling toward the happy ova of possibility. So this is, you know, long time ago, reel-to-reel tape recorders, black and white television we're talking, the last time Paris was under this kind of nationwide state of emergency. And the procedure that they're now under harks back to the start of the Algerian War in the 1950s, going back even further. Now we're in your grandparents' era, giving exceptional powers to authorities. We saw this after 9/11 here in the U.S., exceptional powers to authorities like the Patriot Act. Here you've got 3 days to read 30,000 pages. Where do I sign? or as the Germans did in World War II, the Enabling Act. We'll just get rid of all the constitutional authority and the Führer will decide what's good for you. So now that we have all of this going on all over the world, particularly in France and throughout the EU, we're going to be seeing some stuff like that potentially. And while some are claiming that increased government surveillance is needed, it's needed after the Paris attacks. TechDirt reports that France already expanded surveillance twice in the past year. Perhaps expanding it again may not be the answer. Hard to know. Let's say hi to Colleen Rowley, former FBI special agent, division counsel, whose May 2002 memo to the FBI director exposed some of the FBI's pre-9/11 failures, was named one of Time Magazine's Persons of the Year in 2002. Colleen Rowley wrote to the FBI director again in February 2003 with some hard questions about the reliability of the evidence being added to justify the impending invasion of Iraq. She now warns of terror attacks being used as pretext for official agendas, much as I just reviewed a second ago. She's also warning that bulk collection of personal data, we all know that the NSA has, you know, a square mile at least in Utah of every JPEG you've downloaded, every nudie picture, every email, every phone call, you, honey, you are in the filing cabinet of fun for them right now. That this bulk collection of personal data by government is not only counter to liberty, counter to liberty. Imagine Jefferson going, yeah, go through my desk. Forget that Fourth Amendment that you actually have to have a warrant. Just go through it anyway. That not only is this collection, bulk collection of personal data by government, counter to liberty, but counterproductive to the alleged goal of stopping attacks. She's also written a piece in The Guardian. You can Google her name, Colleen Rowley, Colleen Rowley. You'll see her piece in The Guardian. You can check it out while you're listening. The bigger the haystack, the harder the terrorist is to find. Colleen Rowley, I want to welcome you to The Smart Show, part of GoHarrison.com.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you aboard. And you are in Minneapolis, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct.
Burr is all I can say.
We're sweating here.
Well, good deal. So speaking of warmth, speaking of heating things up, we're saying or that the possibility that the EU through France is going to expand surveillance powers using all of this as a pretext to really come down hard and do even more bulk data collection, much as we have here squawking and screaming everybody from the Tea Party to the big liberals to the big conservatives. Nobody loves Big Brother climbing under your bed sheets without an invitation. I imagine in Europe they have the same sentiment.
And, you know, this is why I think it is so important to explain to people why collecting non-relevant information, what I call the hay, in vacuuming up all this trillions of pieces of data that you just mentioned, is not helping authorities home in on the really relevant info. And in this article I wrote a year ago in The Guardian about the haystack, I documented a number of cases, including the underwear bomber, including Colonel Hassan, who shot at one of our military bases. All of these things should have been turned up if this worked. And in fact, authorities, Keith Alexander and Clapper, after they had lied about the massive intelligence collection, after they had lied about that, then they tried to say, oh, we've solved 54 cases. We've prevented 50-some cases of terrorism through this bulk collection. And in fact, none of them proved true. Edward Snowden maybe says it better than even my haystack metaphor. He says, when you collect everything, you understand nothing. And that's what I think. If people understand this is hurting efforts to prevent terrorism and stop terrorism, in fact, which can't be done this way, then we won't have this issue. There will be no calls to double down and collect even more non-relevant info.
Harrison with you. You are listening to The Smart Show, part of GoHarrison.com. We are taking your live tweets at GoHarrison. At Go Harrison. You can also follow us on Facebook, keyword Go Harrison. Also Instagram, keyword Go Harrison. Have a tweet here from Miami. Woman wants to know about President Hollande seems to be mimicking the U.S. reaction to 9/11, which is just immediately crack down on everybody, just absolutely everybody.
That's right. You know, and this problem is it's called the false positives. You know, the NSA whistleblowers understand it better than anybody because they spent a career, many of them, in mathematics. And so this idea that you crack down on everybody, yeah, I mean, you can round up after 9/11. Look at New York City after 9/11, rounded up 1,000 people, and everyone was like all relieved to realize, oh, my gosh, they're working. They have 1,000 people in custody. It, you know, a couple, 3 years later, even after some of those people, immigrants, were beat up for having been in the wrong place at the wrong time, it was found out that none of the 1,000 had any, there was any evidence or information suggesting that they were terrorists. I should just also mention that in that knee-jerk reaction, you mentioned the Patriot Act, but there was a little more to it than that. And that knee-jerk reaction of rounding up 1,000 people and putting them in jail, sometimes for a year, sometimes beating them up, those 1,000 people also served as justification for initiating torture because people were saying they're not talking. This was in October of 2001. We're going to have to take our gloves off. Those people we've rounded up are not talking. Well, of course, they can't talk. None of them were relevant. They had nothing to do with terrorism. And yet they served as justification for the initiating of torture. Just to back up a bit on the Patriot Act, what they did even before the Patriot Act was the Office of Legal Counsel lawyers, John Yoo and his colleague Robert Delahunty, began to write furiously a whole
I'm just going
to
jump in because we're going to have a lot of folks that are 22 that may not have the institutional memory of the Bush administration 10, 15 years ago. But John Woo was one of Bush's attorneys who decided that torture is actually legal and it's a good thing. And as a lawyer, he can argue why, and it all makes good, clean sense.
You know, I don't think John Woo actually had these ideas on his own. They went to him to legalize what they wanted to do. And so he was considered the legal architect and the person that would try to find legal justifications for torture. Even before that, though, he wrote the basically in two weeks or so after 9/11, he wrote a memo establishing a form of martial law, an emergency. You mentioned this about Nazi Germany. But this idea that when you're in an emergency, that the old constitutional law, well, it can't be a suicide pact, so we have to find ways of curtailing this. And it's essentially a form of martial law. And that was actually instituted via the secret Office of Legal Counsel memos. Nobody knew about it, of course. There was no way to object. So people did know about the Patriot Act, but what they didn't know was that there were memos. We didn't learn about this until, you know, the New York Times, almost four or five years later, and that hospital room standoff where finally Ashcroft decided not to sign one of the emergency orders they kept coming to him. That was all based, not the legalization was based on the fact that the president, the theory, John Hughes' theory, that in wartime, the president obtains full power even to violate the Constitution.
I'm just going to jump in and reintroduce you. People come and go, especially on FM radio. Colleen Rowley, former FBI special agent, division counsel, whose May 2002 memo to the FBI director happened to expose some of the FBI's pre-9/11 failures. Uh-oh. She was later named one of Time Magazine's Persons of the Year. So we're getting the FBI perspective, former FBI perspective, of how stuff is put together, how it's cobbled together, and hearing what we call a brave voice. Not everyone is willing to talk about how stuff is put together, to reverse engineer it, and to put in conversational language how stuff works. This is the Smart Show, part of GoHarrison.com. We're live tweeting at GoHarrison, at GoHarrison, talking to Colleen Rowley. Coming up in just a few minutes, we're also going to jump to talk about the CEO retirement packages, numbers that will be astounding to you, so that you could also navigate your finances. And then later to Dallas, Texas, at the JFK conference, where they're claiming now that LBJ was behind that to some degree. We'll certainly learn some more about that. But right now, Colleen Rowley, we're talking, excuse me, the air is rather yellow today here in Los Angeles. We're talking about lockdown. We're talking about what goes on when governments take over and how the king, much as George Bush, could just usurp all the constitutional principles, take over and act as true commander-in-chief, just commanding. Brussels right now today, that's the seat of the headquarters of NATO and the European Union. Got, almost 200,000 residences living there. It's under complete lockdown. And so there's a lot of latitude to take crazy overreach. And we've learned from Colleen Rowley that overreach means you end up with too much stuff, as Edward Snowden pointed out, too much stuff to be able to sift through even. So overreach is like you miss the point and you end up in other places. So, Colleen, here we are wondering what's next. The French president seems to have a big appetite now to act like George Bush minus the cowboy hat and guns, but you may have the same plot of the play. The French famously, liberté, right? Our own revolution modeled much after them, lobbing off the king or the heads of the great queen there, who had a 15-pound boil on the back of her neck, so the guillotine had to slide twice. One of my favorite facts of history. They're looking to replicate our behavior. Does it seem like the EU and the American government are all sort of together into one way to really discipline the people of Earth for some, I mean, what's the reason for that?
And, you know, the country of Belgium is actually maybe even in a worse emergency panic state in terms of stopping people. I should explain one more thing, which is because we now have this, you know, what I call total information awareness, where trillions of pieces of data have been vacuumed up and put into.
Wasn't that Negroponte who tried to do that, the TIA?
He didn't try. He succeeded. People thought he had not succeeded because there was a rebellion when he said he was going to do this. However, what happened was it actually went on under different acronyms in all of the different agencies. And of course, Snowden, another prior NSA whistleblowers, told us about the NSA one, but all of these different databases exist. They are peopled with, you know, not just millions, but billions and trillions of pieces of data. What they try to do, because it's unwieldy and unworkable, is they try to make things like no-fly lists and the terrorist watch list. The terrorist watch list now in the United States has only 1.1 million people on it. That's a lot of foreign people, but it's also quite a few Americans. Now, you can realize that 1.1 million people are not all terrorists. And so even when they've tried to winnow down and purify these trillions into something like 1.1 million, they still have problems with not putting Abdulmutallab, for instance, and there was lots of reasons why he should have been put on the terrorist watch list, was not. And neither was Hassan, etc. So this is
just to put into perspective here, if we have 1.1 million people on the terrorist watch list and we have 327 million Americans, that would mean one in 327 people is a terrorist.
Right, right.
Which means you wouldn't even have be able to run a 7-Eleven within a block without a daily or a momentary problem going on constantly. If that were a true scenario,
and of course, like I said, a lot of these are foreign people, and then the foreign countries. You mentioned the EU. All of the EU and the Five Eyes have different databases. Sometimes shared. I would hope that a lot of it is shared, but not all of it. Perhaps they all have their own databases besides. So I want to explain that before the fact and the problem of and with hindsight, because. When Clapper and Alexander tried to justify this massive collection and tried to justify going around the Constitution, these illegal things, they tried to scare people by saying that they had prevented 54 incidents of terrorism. And, of course, the media found out that wasn't true. What you can't do, even collecting massive, I don't care if you put even tons of people in jail, you cannot prevent acts of terrorism. And you certainly can't prevent acts of terrorism when you are absolutely increasing the number of terrorists through war. You're increasing your war zone. The United States started off with Afghanistan and Iraq. They added Libya. They added Somalia. They are helping Saudi Arabia now bomb Yemen. So across the Mideast, this war zone has grown exponentially. And as it grows, what they're doing, of course, they're radicalizing all kinds of people. So they're increasing the number of would-be, could-be terrorist suspects, and at the same time trying to assure Americans that because of the massive collection, they can protect everyone and prevent terrorism. So this is a fool's errand, and the quicker people wake up to the impossibility of doing that. But I wanted to mention one thing. The massive data collection is a little bit like the J. Edgar Hoover's brilliant idea to start a fingerprint repository in order to solve crimes after they've been committed. And if you can find a latent fingerprint. And so by having that repository, now you can put that latent fingerprint in there, and you can, you know, this is decades and decades now, they were able, in some cases where they got a latent fingerprint, to completely and very accurately identify a culprit of a crime after it had occurred. So what they're trying to do now is input biometric data into this massive collection so that it's a little bit more meaningful than it already than it was before. Obviously, it doesn't take much to make it more meaningful, but they're putting iris scans and fingerprints and even DNA into this collection to dovetail. And then the second thing is, once a crime has occurred, as happened in Paris, now they can go query and they can find all of the contacts of the people that they identify. So that is what you're seeing now in Belgium and in France, is you're seeing them having gone to their computers, seen all the contacts and connections, and now the police raiding and searching all of these. You know, let's hope it's not two or three hops out, that it's at least it's a direct connection. But unfortunately, these things are going to be fraught with error as well.
I appreciate your comments. We've run out of time, but I want to thank you so much, Colleen Rowley, for having joined us here on the Smart Show, part of GoHarrison.com. A former FBI special agent, division counsel, who's made 2002 memo to the FBI director, happy to expose many of the FBI's pre-9/11 failures. She was later named one of Time Magazine's Persons of the Year. Thank you again, Colleen Rowley, for joining us today.
Yes, anytime.
Look forward to having you back on. Coming up, we are going to talk about the CEOs, the one percenters, how much dough they walk away with, which happens to be equivalent to half of what all the rest of us in America make. That's coming up in just a sec.
Go Harrison. Talk show. Political. Outrageous. Philosophical. Analytical. Passionate. Sunsets. Roadkill cooking tips. GoHarrison.com. This station presents Real American Heroes.
Real American Heroes.
Today, we salute you, Mr. Tofu-Eating Thanksgiving Vegetarian.
Mr. Tofu-Eating Thanksgiving Vegetarian.
Yes, thanks to you, grandmothers across the land will soon be asking, would you like white meat, dark meat, or a beige-colored cube of steamed bean curd?
We'd like to beat you with a drumstick.
And Mr. Tofu-Eating Thanksgiving Vegetarian, because you won't touch the turkey, you feel it's well within your rights to devour the entire platter of mashed potatoes.
And all of the gravy, too.
Hey, doofus, gravy contains turkey drippings.
We made you eat some.
So before you take that tryptophan-induced power nap during the football game, unbuckle your pants and salute to the girly man chewing on alfalfa sprouts, Mr. Tofu-Eating Thanksgiving Vegetarian, a real American hero.
Mr. Tofu-Eating Thanksgiving Vegetarian.
For the last time, there's no real meat in mincemeat pie, okay? JoeHarrison.com.
Hi there. This is Arnold Schwarzenegger. Happy Thanksgiving, turkey man.
Preventing truth decay.
Truth decay.
Live from Hollywood. This is Harrison.
According to USA Today, the 100 largest U.S. CEO retirement packages are worth a combined, let's just call it $5 billion. That's equal to the entire retirement account savings of 41%, nearly half of American families. And that's a report by the Center for Effective Government and the Institute for Policy Studies watchdog groups. That's why I want to bring to you right now Scott Klinger. He's the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government, which co-published the study titled Tale of Two Retirements, which is a little nod to our British author friends, because it was grim, indeed, back then in the Dickensian era, something that doesn't seem too dissimilar if you pull the camera back and kind of look at the balance of the 327 million of us here. A tiny fraction at the very top are really enjoying the yachting experience, and the rest of the people are trying to figure out how to get it done. And Scott Klinger, I want to welcome you to Go Harrison.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So we're looking at the top CEOs. This is no secret. For the last 10 years, we've been talking about the disparity between what CEOs get paid and what the average worker gets paid. But we're looking at retirement now, CEOs with hundreds of millions, perhaps, in retirement funds. And then the guy who works at, let's say, Taco Bell, one of the ones involved in this, or Pizza Hut or Kentucky Fried Chicken, they're not sitting around with a big 401k necessarily.
That's right. We did this report because we know Americans are aware there's a retirement crisis, but the general story is that the problem is that people haven't saved enough, and we think that's the wrong story. The wrong story is that responsibility for a secure retirement has shifted dramatically from being a responsibility of the employer onto the employee over the last 30 years. And you cite the example of Taco Bell, the most extreme example in our report. The former CEO, he was CEO until the end of last year, of Yum Brands, which owns Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, and KFC, has the highest retirement plan we found, over $234 million, which will give him a monthly retirement check of $1.3 million each and every month from the time he retires to the day he dies. In contrast, his company employs over 500,000 workers. We don't know exactly how many are in the U.S. because they only give us a global number, but we know just from looking around that there's an awful lot of Taco Bell, Pizza Huts, and KFCs. So we know that there's probably hundreds of thousands of workers in the United States, and less than 9,000 of them have any sort of retirement plan available in their workplace. So we think that's pretty alarming, shameful, and pretty bad public policy that those sorts of things are allowed.
Harrison with you. We are talking to Scott Klinger. You can check out their website, foreffectivegov, as in government, foreffectivegov.org, foreffectivegov.org. If you want to check it out, support them and get behind this, it's only your life. And often it kind of boils down to that, is that our grandparents had pensions and they were pretty much guaranteed. I don't think Wall Street, if my grandfather had such a thing, was allowed to go gamble that thing like they're in a casino, like a drunken hooker. He was guaranteed real money at the end of the day. That's gone the way of the dodo bird for so many.
That's absolutely right. I think the private pensions peaked in the 1980s, right around the time that President Reagan fired all the air traffic controllers and busted their union. And there's been kind of a decline, steady decline in both unionization and pension assets since the early 80s for the last 35 years. And that's something that we need to think about and turn around and I think band back together and demand that we have greater retirement security. One of the things that really concerns us is some in Congress now are talking about cutting back Social Security or reducing benefits or putting off the retirement age from 65 to 70 or 66 to 70. These are all very bad ideas as more people are dependent on Social Security as their only means of support when they retire.
We're talking right now to Scott Klinger. He's the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government. You can just Google that. Their stuff will come up. Their easy website is foreffectivegov.org. And we're taking a look at what retirement looks like for any of us here. We're also taking your live tweets at Go Harrison. One word, at Go Harrison. You can also follow us on Facebook, keyword Go Harrison. Same thing, Instagram, Go Harrison. And here's a tweet coming in wondering what as we try to compress a 140-character tweet, basically, are these all white guys, or do they reflect the complexion of what America really looks like, the ones with $1 million a month in retirement?
So that's a really great question, and it's not something we went looking for when we started the report. But when we finished and ranked the Fortune 500 CEOs in the size of their retirement plans, we found, in fact, that the top 10 were all white males, and their collective, the top 10 highest white males pension plans, retirement plans, was totaled $1.4 billion. We then looked at the 10 largest female CEOs' plans, and their total was $277 million, about a sixth of the white males. And CEOs of color, the top 10 CEOs of color, were less than $200 million, $196 million, so they were even less than the women. We thought, well, you know, maybe the white men have just been in the workforce longer. Maybe they have more years of service and tenure. But we found quite the opposite, that the men had fewer years of service than both the group of 10 women and the group of 10 CEOs of color. So, you know, the same sorts of dynamics we see in the regular workforce, that white men make more than women and people of color in the same jobs, also holds true in the executive suites.
So here's a tweet from Miami, listening to your answer there and wondering how they can get away with this. Clearly, there are supposed to be laws where everyone has the same kind of access. That may be an impossible one to answer, but
it's actually another great question, because there are two sets of laws. So you and I, if we're one of the 50% of the American workforce that has access to a 401k at work, we have strict limits on how much we can put aside before taxes into our 401k. If you're under 50, you can put $18,000 a year in your 401k. If you're over 50, you get to put a little more, $24,000. But CEOs don't have any limits in their deferred compensation plan. So one of them, the guy who runs Progressive Insurance, the company that has the Flo ads on TV, he put in $26 million in his deferred compensation plan last year, and doing so saved $10 million on his income taxes last April. So, you know, we need one set of laws for everybody. There's reasons why we subsidize workers' retirement plans and allow people to put pre-tax money into their 401ks, but it shouldn't be an endless amount. It should be a reasonable amount, like we have for normal workers.
Scott Klinger here with us. You are listening to Go Harrison. We're on the Pacifica Radio Network on the west coast of California, also on the Progressive Radio Network, east coast United States. You can catch a podcast of this and any other broadcast anytime at GoHarrison.com, GoHarrison.com. Also send your live tweets at Go Harrison, where there's another one that's just come in wanting to know about the retirement funds that the CEOs have that are different from what everyone else has, that they're speculating or positing that Congress must have a hand in this. They are, after all, the ones representing you and me. Surely they wouldn't want us to, I'm adding in the sarcasm here, you could tell I'm freelancing it, surely Congress wouldn't want us to wither and the CEOs to flourish.
Well, I think, you know, the rules is exactly why we wrote this report. And I talked about the two sets of rules when it comes to deferred compensation and 401k plans. You know, one of the other things that we find objectionable is that companies are allowed to deduct the costs of their CEO retirement plans from their taxes, even if they have reduced or eliminated their employee retirement benefits. So one of the other companies in our report is a company whose CEO, it's the CEO of McKesson. They're the largest drug distributor in the country. And his pension assets are so large that if you look at them over the number of years he's worked, he is getting essentially more than $23,000 a day for each day he's worked into his retirement account. His retirement account is over $100 million, and he's worked for like a dozen or so years. And so these sorts of things, you know, they're crazy. Like, you know, people would be happy to get $23,000 for a month of work, let alone in their retirement plan. They think they've died and gone to heaven. So we need to really fix these things, that limit these things, and say, you know, these ridiculous amounts shouldn't be subsidized by taxpayers by allowing companies to deduct them on their taxes.
And we'll get into solutions in just a second. Here's a tweet from Marjorie, @GoHarrison, wants to know how these companies, or why these companies, would hand such a fortune up to the CEO. Like, what's the benefit to the company to do that?
Well, one of the stories in this report is that, you know, we really saw a shift in 1980. Companies used to believe that having secure workers in their retirement was good for them. And if you think about it, it makes business sense. We live in a consumer economy. We want retirees to not be eating cat food and you know, having other problems. We want them to have lives where they can perhaps go out to dinner, buy some toys for their grandkids, maybe take a little vacation now and again, and spend some money that helps small businesses and all businesses. What happened in the 1980s, and actually 1990s, was President Clinton signed a law that allowed companies unlimited deductions of their executive pay if the pay was performance-based. So at that point, we saw a lot of CEO pay shift from being in cash to in stock. And because stock prices go up if earnings are better, CEOs had a new incentive to reduce their costs and boost their earnings.
So, therefore the performance.
Guess what? One of the things they cut was employee retirement benefits. So they shifted people from defined pensions, where if the stock market goes up or down, the company's on the hook to make up the difference, to 401ks, where if the market goes down, you lose and it doesn't affect the company.
Interestingly enough, and if I'm not too clear on my history, I recall being taught that back in the 1930s and 40s, instead of getting, say, health care from a national way, though post-World War II, we made sure that Germany and Japan, other places that we had devastated, got universal health care because we knew their nations could not survive and rebuild themselves without, like, Band-Aids. You know, basic suturing going on here. And the idea was that the company would give you these particular benefits, defer your salary. So instead of making, say, $100,000 as a worker, you might get $60,000. But knowing when you turned into a geezer and you were starting to wobble on a cane, you were going to get the rest of that salary for the rest of your natural life. So a deferred payment. Wasn't that the idea originally? And now it's totally changed. It's like you get to work, and we pay you. It's a payout. When you're done getting paid. It's right. Still a lower wage than ever, but you don't get that back end side, which was the whole point to show up. Is like, yeah, I'll take a lower wage, but at least I know when my teeth fall out, I'm going to be able to, you know, have some high quality applesauce. That's gone.
Absolutely, and it also destroys the incentive for companies, for people to be loyal to their employers, right? So if one of the ideas of working for a company with a pension was you had to stay there and work in order to get the pension. So now, you know, people have a 401k, they leave, they take their 401k with them, they go someplace else for a few years, they leave there, and now they have two 401ks following them around if they're lucky. So I think that all that has really made, you know, businesses weaker. Whenever someone leaves, if they're a good employee, they take a lot of relationships and organizational history and knowledge with them. I don't see how that's a good thing, and I don't see that why that's something that businesses would want to encourage.
Scott Klinger is Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at Center for Effective Government. You can check out their website, foreffectivegov, that's F-O-R, effectivegov.org. And there you're going to see a breakdown of all of this, what we're talking about, and how this is structured, so that for the first time for many of us, we're actually getting a glimpse. And Scott said that they weren't necessarily looking to discover every component, because what is unknown is unknown. As Rumsfeld said, the unknown unknowns. But you found that, using Rumsfeld again, the unknowns became knowable knowables, which is even more sort of ghastly in a big sense. I'm wondering, Scott, what some of the solutions might be, because admittedly, none of us, I mean, I am not a day trader. I am not an expert at my stock. I hold a 401k. How in God's name should I understand the nuances of not only tax code, tax laws, how a portfolio may go up and down, hedge funds. Like, you know, my name is Mildred. I live in Ohio. And now I'm supposed to be an expert working for Charles Schwab, and I'm just somebody.
I'm stuck with that now as a 401k holder, aren't I?
Yeah, that's really part of the problem. And 401k plans have very high fees that really increase Wall Street's profits. One of the solutions that some people are trying in some of the states is allowing ordinary citizens in the states into the state pension plans as a kind of a subplan within the state pension funds. State pension funds are professionally managed. They have really low fees because they're very large pools of money. They tend to be quite conservatively managed because the state's trying to manage the assets of its retirees. And so so that's been a useful alternative for many that many states are experimenting with. I think it's too early to say whether it's a solution nationwide, but it's something important to watch. We think there should be a conversation about whether to expand Social Security. You know, a third of people who are of retirement age of 50, between 50 and 65 have no retirement assets and will be wholly dependent on Social Security. The average Social Security payment right now is $1,223 a month, or less than $15,000 a year. Hard to imagine retiring on that in most parts of the country. So we think we need to think about how to expand Social Security, and we think we can pay for expanding Social Security by closing some of these CEO pay loopholes, by eliminating the endless deduction of CEO pay, by requiring CEOs to have the same limits on their deferred compensation plans as ordinary workers. And here's another one that we didn't talk about, but large government contractors often have very large retirement plans and pensions for their CEOs. This is our money that's going to these companies in large government contracts. They're making a lot of money off of it, and then they're turning around and giving their CEOs big pensions. The CEO of Honeywell, it's one of the nation's largest contractors, will enjoy a pension plan that's 50 times what President Obama's will be when he leaves office.
To your point, Scott Klinger, when I was in Chicago, so this is probably 18, 19 years ago, when Westinghouse bought CBS and suddenly we became part of the Defense Department, and I was forbidden, by the way, to do any stories on Trident nuclear submarines or anything that shot bullets, I was suddenly allowed to throw, I think, 13% or maybe, you know, 16% of my weekly paycheck into a 401k. I mean, it was beautiful. I thought everyone could do that. Not the case. Not the case. And I've had to live on that down to its dwindling nothingness, but it was one of those luxuries because I was connected to that kind of system unknowingly at the time. Yep. Now I know greater. If that were available for everyone, it certainly would change the tune. And I think one of the myths that we get as we study Social Security a little bit is it's really bunkum saying the thing is bankrupt, it sucks, it doesn't work, it never did. It's simply not true.
Absolutely. It owns the same bonds that J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs and most people's pension funds have in bulk. So it's a general bond paid by backed by the U.S. government. So, you know, if they're good enough for Goldman Sachs, they should be good enough for Social Security.
and, you know, let's take a Koch brother or maybe somebody from Goldman Sachs as well. Anybody who's hell bent, a Tea Party fellow perhaps or whatever to diminish, disentangle, dilute, make dissolute Social Security. Like, why would you want to do that? Like, what's the upside to that? I don't really get it. Why do you want 300 million armed people roaming around in the streets, hungry and savage? How does that make for a civil society or a safe place for your own daughter to grow up in?
Well, I think part of the problem, and it's a reasonable note to draw to conclusion here, is that we've come apart as seeing ourselves as having a relationship to one another, and we've just become this every person for themselves society. It's really become a problem for CEOs because, you know, they used to occasionally rub arms with ordinary people, whether they flew commercial planes or sort of at kids' baseball games or other things, and now they live in this rarefied world of private jets and helicopters and express elevators that carry them from the lobby to the top floor of a skyscraper. These things are not good things in terms of having a cohesive society in which we're all in it together. So I think that's something we all need to figure our way back to. Shows like yours are great for kind of having that conversation on. I wish there was more of them.
Well, I appreciate your vote of faith here, and you are the reason I'm here. because you exist. You're the one doing the heavy lifting. You're out there fighting. You're bringing us the information. I mean, I wish I could just turn to, let's say, our news director and say, hey, how come we're actually not doing this story? How come it has to be in the entertainment section as opposed to the fucking news at the top of the hour? Why is that? Well, because the American people don't want it. They don't understand it. They're not capable. They want to hear about the Kardashians. And I don't believe that to be true for a minute. I imagine when people hear what you have to say, Scott, every Christmas tree light bulb in their imagination of possibility fires up nice and bright.
That's right. And the one thing we want people to know is things have been good before. They were good between the end of the Second World War and the 1980s because people banded together and they can be good again, but we need to fight.
All right, my friend. Your website is foreffectivegov.org. That's foreffectivegov.org, foreffectivegov.org. We've been talking to Scott Klinger, Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at Center for Effective Government, which co-published the study titled Tale of Two Retirements. You can Google it. Up it will come. Read about it yourself. Understand it. And also, because so many of us are creative, especially our millennial friends who can think in multi-levels, multitasking. Imagine the solution to this and let us all know, because we will be on board, I can assure you. I want to thank you, Scott, so much for having joined us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, my friend. Be well. Harrison with you. You have been listening to Go Harrison. We are part of GoHarrison.com, where a podcast of this and any other broadcast is available at GoHarrison.com 24/7, plus a lot of photos of travel and other cool stuff. You can always, always, always contact us via Twitter at GoHarrison, at GoHarrison. Also, please follow us on Facebook, keyword GoHarrison. Look forward to talking to you next time.
GoHarrison.com.
Coming up in just a few moments, we're going to go to Dallas, Texas, where they're about to put together and put on the air and put in front of the public and even live stream a JFK conference that indicates that LBJ, the vice president under JFK, was actually responsible for his death. This being hosted by Lee Harvey Oswald's ex-girlfriend. Oh, my.
Lock it in. Coming up, more Harrison on The Smart Show.
Hello, I'm Martha Stewart, and I'm thankful that no one has discovered the bodies I buried in the crawl space of my Connecticut home. If they had, I'd be doing a heck of a lot more than 5 months at Camp Cupcake. And that's a good thing. Happy Thanksgiving.
And just in time for Christmas, Shronko presents Mudfish Hitch's Yuletime Greetings, as played on his body organ. You'll hear such familiars as Jingle Bell. Silent Night. Favorite, Deck the Halls. Send $9.95 for cassette or CD to Mudfish Hitch's Yuletime Greetings. Don't let this offer pass you by.
GoHarrison.com.
Harrison with you, and as you know, we have just passed yet another anniversary of the JFK assassination, something that simply doesn't go away. Probably the most famous assassination of a president in U.S. history. We all know about Abe Lincoln, but there isn't the same appetite, maybe because many of us are alive or were alive when this happened. Certainly our parents, grandparents were, and it's also what reflects a time, an era in which
many of us find ourselves once again living. Cold wars popping up, terrorists left and right, presidents who wanted to do something good, people behind the scenes, a government that simply feels like it cannot be trusted, which is many people's current reality. There are lots of heroes who have gone unnamed, unsung, invisibly in the background, working very hard to bring forth information that wouldn't otherwise be available. One of them is a guy named Chris Milliken, and he, since 2001, 2002, put together a company to be able to publish books, books that would be otherwise not only unavailable, blocked, spiked, banned. He has been able to publish them and get them out into circulation. He's also a writer and a musician, and after first working in 2001 with an author and investigative reporter, Daniel Hopsinger, and producing Barry and the Boys, the CIA, the Mob, and America's Secret History, he started Trine Day Books in 2002 as a way to get suppressed books, to get them wider circulation. And with no shortage of spiked materials, Trine Day has now grown to over 70 volumes of print, succeeded in achieving a wider distribution for suppressed works than any other publisher in the U.S. Their current catalog can be seen, and write this down or check it out while you're listening to the conversation. Trine Day, one word, T-R-I-N-E, TrineDay.com, TrineDay.com. And Chris edited, is author of Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. Yep, that's it. George Bush, Skull and Bones at Yale. My grandfather was a member, allegedly, of that. Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society. He's a prolific songwriter with two songs in National Lampoon's Last Resort. And Chris is in Waterville, Oregon, where he is right now. Well, let's flash forward back to JFK, circle back around. The third annual JFK Assassination Conference being hosted by Judith Baker. That's the former girlfriend of Lee Harvey Oswald. She was the last one really to see him alive. His confidant and lover as well, Lee Harvey Oswald's girlfriend. It's going to be in Dallas, Texas, November 20 to the 22nd, coming up in just about a week. And I want to welcome you to Go Harrison, Chris Milliken.
Oh, boy, thank you. I tell you, this is exciting.
Was that a lofty enough introduction for you, or do you want 10 more paragraphs?
No, that's wonderful, I tell you. I mean, I can skate for the rest of my life on that. Heck of a deal.
Now, you guys are producing a Conscious Community Events. This is the JFK Historical Group. You're going to have over 20 nationally known researchers. You're going to have scholars all getting together in Dallas at the Crown Plaza Hotel, just a few blocks away from Dealey Plaza. And this conference is going to be open to the public. You've got tickets on sale, jfkconference.com, jfkconference.com. What's the upshot? What are we going to learn after all these years with the millions of questions, the Warren Commission, Oliver Stone's movie of 20 years ago? What do we now know is going on?
Well, the JFK research community can be rather contentious, and everybody doesn't agree on every little minutia. But the thing that we're doing is we're concentrating on some of the things that we agree and that have really come to bear, because, I mean, it was 52 years ago. There has been a lot of water under the bridge. There has been a lot of research done. There's been a lot of documents released, and people have talked, okay? So the two things that we can really agree on within this community is that Oswald... he was involved with intelligence, and he was a patsy, just like he said.
And so I'm going to jump in, and just so people get what you're saying or what you're about to say, and I'm going to say it in a simple sentence. Lee Harvey Oswald appears to be innocent.
Absolutely. And actually helped inform us about the plot. And the other thing that we can really agree on is that it was a coup d'etat. And we are living still with the results of that, sadly.
Harrison, with you, we are talking to, I'm just going to jump in for a second because people come and go here. We're talking to Chris Milligan. He's the publisher of Trine Day Books. They've been around for greater than 15 years, publishing suppressed book titles and bringing forth authors, including Judith Vary Baker, who's going to be at this JFK conference. She was the former girlfriend, surviving girlfriend of Lee Harvey Oswald, a holder of many of his secrets, and they have discovered that Lee Harvey Oswald, apparently, I can only say apparently, appears to be completely innocent, a patsy used, manipulated, because he was working for the CIA, as a matter of fact. And let's jump into that here, Chris. From what I remember in talking a couple of times with Judith Vary Baker, the former Lee Harvey Oswald girlfriend who wrote her book, Lee and Me, Lee was bringing radiolytic properties or radioactive materials from Oak Ridge, Tennessee, the largest radioactive rendering plant where we make these things, these supplies, radioactive supplies, whether they're for nuclear power plants or whatever, bringing radioactive materials from there to New Orleans, where she, as a young girl, was manipulating cancer viruses or cancer cells by exposing them to radiation and making them really vicious. So cancer that might take somebody out in a number of months or even a year, they were able to accelerate cancer's appetite so that it could dispatch somebody in a month or less. That cancer was then by the CIA meant to be injected into Fidel Castro to take him out. That was So that's Oswald's job, was to bring the radioactive elements so that she could manipulate cancer to create a weapon to kill Fidel Castro.
Yes, they were weaponizing Castro, and one of the main jobs that Oswald seemed to be doing within this operation was to be acting as a courier. And she had started to work with radioactive materials when she was in high school. And so she was a innocent and a very person that wasn't well known that could be brought in to this operation. And it's just amazing. The book's name is Me and Lee. And then also, Judith wrote a book about David Ferry because she knew David Ferry. And it's just amazing.
Let's say who David Ferry is, because we're going to have people that are 15 and 16 years old listening right now, and they think about something like Tinkerbell flapping around, and we don't mean that kind of fairy, or maybe we do at the same time.
Well, David Ferry is a very, very interesting person. He taught both Lee Harvey Oswald and another gentleman that they may not know about, Barry Seal, how to fly. He was in the Civil Air Patrol. He was in the JFK movie. He was played by Joe Pesci. And he was an amazing individual. And he got involved in the JFK plot in New Orleans. And told that was one of the ways how Lee Harvey Oswald got involved with it. And it's just an amazing book because Judy... she was 19 when she went to New Orleans that summer of 1963 and met Lee Oswald. He was three years older than she was. And she met all these amazing people. And most of these people that were also involved in this secret project, like Guy Bannister, Dr. Mary Sherman, David Ferry, they're all dead.
And you'll be able to hear more of this at GoHarrison.com. But right now, let's go to Jason Crow with Healthy Living.
Reality Check with Harrison. Healthy Living.
Jason!
Hey, what's up, buddy? How are you?
How are you, my friend? Give us the update. What's cooking today to keep us healthy?
You know when Mom used to always tell you when you were young?
Get a little closer to your microphone, if you would.
Oh, yeah. Do you know when your mother used to tell you to chew your food and eat slowly?
Even closer.
Oh, well, I am...
There you go.
What we're going for, I'm going to talk about today, is the argument between eating your food fast, chewing your food, and then the types of food. Like, for example, smoothies and solid foods and soups. Well, it's been shown that honestly, smoothies, although being really wonderful for you, are usually consumed fairly quick. And because they're fairly quickly consumed, a lot of times our body is being tricked into not thinking it hasn't gotten enough calories. So a lot of times we're not full. So this can lead to actually more eating later on, which of course is a bad thing because that means you're adding more calories to your diet. Some studies have been done to show that actually taking our time with eating a drink of a blended juice can be better appropriate in our body if we actually take 10, 15, 20, 30 minutes as if we were actually eating the solid form, because our body has a trigger in it. And it's really interesting that if a long period of time we're consuming these calories, it's going to have a full effect on us. And it's not so much a number of calories, it's more the effect of us taking our time. Our bodies have been through history. We're, you know, back years ago, but when we didn't have all these ovens and everything was cooked slowly, we took our time with eating. So it kind of works the same way now. We need to take our time drinking our smoothies or eating our food, as well as soups. Soups have a...
So Jason, what we're saying is that if you eat slowly, the body thinks it's having a lot of food. If you eat quickly, it's like a dog. You guzzle the food in 23 seconds, and your body doesn't know that it's actually eaten. It thinks it just had an hors d'oeuvre.
Exactly. You see, especially if you're trying to lose weight, Carrie, you definitely want to take your time eating your food. You'll get more full of effect, a more full effect, and you won't have as many calories per day consuming. So that's a lot better if you're trying to drop the weight. Now, if you want to gain weight, then flip it. Do the exact opposite. If you're trying to put on some pounds for a movie role or want to get bigger because you want to try to, you know, whatever it is, you
movie
consume
role.
It quickly.
Yes. Like all the people in the Midwest who are listening, yes, that's what I want to do, is gain weight
for a
movie role.
Well, maybe you're into powerlifting and you're going to be doing some, you know, whatever. You want to just gain weight for football or something. That's the Midwest sport. So consume that quickly. But remember,
all right, my friend, thank you so much, Jason Crowe. Give us the 411 how we follow you.
You got it, buddy. You can reach me at Twitter or Instagram at Jason D. Crowe, as JasonDCrowe, or reach me email at jasoncrowefitness@gmail.com. Thanks a bunch, Gary.
All right, my friend. Harris with you. See you next week.
GoHarrison.com.
Do you want to know the latest news or upcoming events? Follow us at Twitter at PRN.